In 1976, I began a cross-country road trip on my way to seminary. I traveled with a friend. We had time, so we decided to take back roads. One afternoon, the road passed through rural western Pennsylvania. Late in that day, we came down through hill country into a valley. It had been raining hard, and as we neared a small town, we noticed blinking yellow lights warning us of danger. We saw fields covered in standing water and passed several side roads blocked off with signs saying road closed. "Looks like they've had a flood here," we said. Coming into town, we crossed a bridge over a wide river. The water was high and muddy and flowing fast, and sandbags lined the roadway. "Gosh," we said, "they must have had quite a bit of high water to contend with here. Looks like they've had a major flood." We headed out of town following a winding country road, captivated by the evidence all around us that there had been a dramatic flood. Then we rounded a bend, and in front of us, a sheet of water covered the roadway. The water was rising fast, like a huge silver balloon being inflated before our eyes. We stopped and started to turn the car around, but the water was rising behind us as well. And suddenly we realized that the flood hadn't happened yesterday or last week. It was happening here and now. Dry ground was disappearing fast. We hurriedly climbed out of our car and scrambled to higher ground. Soaked to the bone, we huddled under a fir tree. No longer were we lodged in our familiar vehicle. The cold water of the storm poured down on us, baptizing us into the present, a present from which we had been both insulated by both our car and our misjudgments about the country we were traveling through. This is what it is like to be white in America. It is to travel well ensconced in a secure vehicle, to see signs of what is happening in the world outside the compartment one is traveling in, and not realize that these signs have any contemporary meaning. It is to be dislocated, to misjudge your location, and to believe you are uninvolved and unaffected by what is happening in the world. The moment my friend and I left our car and felt the rain falling on our bodies, soaking our skin, and had to exert ourselves to scramble for safety was a blessed moment. Not because there's any virtue in danger, but because it was a moment when disoriented, alienated consciousness was for a moment interrupted. We became present to our environment. We ceased being passive observers or commentators. Our whole beings, bodies, minds, and sense became involved with the requirements of the situation. We arrived. We entered in. We left our compartment and inhabited the world. No longer tourists passing through the country, we became part of the place along with everyone else that day, in that corner of western Pennsylvania, in that storm. I speak of this experience as baptism because it was a conversion from distance to presence, from misconception to realization. It was an awakening to life, an advance into participation, and a birth into the world. This is the conversion that is needed for those of us who are white Americans. We need to move from a place of passive, misconstrued observation about our country to a place of active, alert participation in our country. The struggle for racial justice in America calls those of us who are white to make this journey. Our presence is needed. We have been absent for too long. The words of Rebecca Parker.
This sermon is mostly for the white folks among us, starting with myself. And of course, not everybody in this room is necessarily white. It's important to say that, but you probably don't need to look around to realize that most of us are. Just as was the case last week, and 5 years ago, and 50 years ago, and in Unitarian Universalism 200 years ago in New England. The Reverend Mark Morrison Reed, a person of color who is a UU minister today, observes that although we don't like to think of our faith as an ethnic religion, it is. You can see this, he writes, in our race, 91.5% Euro-American, our education, 17.2 years on average, our language, English, our style of worship, no amen corners here, our principles, seven of them, and not a word about Jesus, and our social norms. Who we are, he concludes, reflects our Yankee heritage and upper middle class, progressive, NPR, North American values. Well, for a long time, we have yearned to be something more than an ethnic religion. You can hear that yearning come up in conversations and surveys across the UU Association year after year. And in the next couple weeks, I'll talk a little more about that. But for today, what I'd like to invite us to do, those of us who are white and who have been mostly driving obliviously in our car, separate from much of the rest of America, I'd like to invite us to step outside the car. This, to me, is the first step, to actually see the world as it is, especially how our sisters and brothers of color might experience the world. My story may be similar to some of yours. When I think about it, which hasn't been very often, I have to admit that I have led an amazingly segregated life. I grew up in a suburb which was 99% white. When an African-American family moved into our elementary school neighborhood, that was news. When a Chinese-American family moved into middle school, that was news. In spite of a diverse downtown location, the church I grew up in was 99% white. I went to an overwhelmingly white college. I went to a more diverse graduate school in Chicago, but the University of Chicago was a mostly white enclave in the mostly black south side of Chicago, and there really is remarkably little interaction between people of different races. I have dated exclusively whites, with one brief exception in college. In all my jobs, I can only think of two people of color who were co-workers. My wife and I have invited a few people of color into our house for dinner, but not all that many. And this fellowship, according to our recent ministerial search survey, is 99% white. Last year, I attended a workshop on race and racism, which started with a question from the facilitator that really got my attention. The question was, when was the first time you had a teacher of a different race from you? And then she went on, how often did this occur? When was the first time you had a teacher of the same race as you? How often did this occur? What are the implications for this? Well, the first time I had a teacher from a different race from me was my second year in college. So every single teacher I had in elementary school, in middle school, in high school, my first year of college, you can even throw in substitute teachers, every single one was white. And here's the kicker. Until that workshop last year, until that question was asked, I had never even thought about it. Now, if my teachers had looked anything like America, I would have had like 25 to 30 teachers who were people of color, but I had none, and I never even noticed it. It felt perfectly normal. My segregated life has felt perfectly normal to me. In truth, I've been driving in my comfortable little car, not really part of the whole, and not even aware of that fact. The African Americans living 4 miles from my house as a kid, they might as well have been on Mars for all the interaction I had with them. So when it comes to race, I have to admit that I have lived mostly in a state of naive innocence, ignorance, and obliviousness. I believe a lot of white people in America live in the same state. And also I believe that racism depends on this fact. We can be well-meaning, good people, but if we live in a state of naive innocence, ignorance, and obliviousness, chances are good we are not going to do much in our own lives or in society to end racism. So we need to get out of the car, we need to open our eyes, and engage with the rest of the world beyond our segregated communities. We need to listen, talk some, learn, practice, reflect. All of this is why I decided to put this sermon series on race and racism in the context of our year-long exploration of spiritual transitions. A trigger for a spiritual transition can be the awakening of consciousness. When we have an awakening of consciousness, doorways can swing open to transformation, to change. And so an important step, I think, for our country, coming to terms with this original sin of our country, racism, is an awakening of consciousness for many whites. I think many of us, many more of us, need to get out of the car. We need to move from naive innocence, ignorance, and obliviousness to greater knowledge, skills, and wisdom. And what will we see when we step outside the car and look around? I think the first thing we'll see, if we're honest, is privilege for whites and a lack of privilege for people of color. And when we're driving obliviously in this comfortable car, we don't see that. And yet it's so important, so simple but important. Now, I have to share that I did not personally participate in genocide against the Indian people who lived in this land. I did not personally enslave Africans. I did not personally engage in lynching African Americans. I did not choose to be born into the segregated life I have lived. I did not initially choose to exploit people of color for my economic advantage. But the fact is, all those things I have benefited from. I live on stolen land. My ancestors and I benefit from people of color providing work for no wages, as in slavery, or low wages. Even today, the stuff I buy, from milk to staying in hotels to buying clothing made in China or Vietnam, these are all cheaper as a result of people of color working for lower wages. The scholar Peggy McIntosh describes white privilege as the invisible package of unearned assets which I can count on cashing in each day, but about which I was meant to remain oblivious. White privilege is like an invisible, weightless knapsack of special provisions, maps, passports, code books, visas, clothes, tools, and blank checks. Well, I want to share some of the everyday ways I benefit from white privilege. One is I don't have to worry about being pulled over for driving or walking while black. When I was at the University of Chicago, near the end of my 3 years there, I heard another student tell me something that shocked me. A student, an African American student, shared that he was asked to show his ID on almost a daily basis by university police or the people on the university bus system. In my 3 years there, I wasn't asked once to show my ID. Another benefit of white privilege, I've never noticed security guards following me in stores. I don't have to worry about what others are maybe thinking, that we're isolating ourselves when I sit with a table of whites eating lunch together. I'm not targeted by relentless and ubiquitous ads selling alcohol and tobacco and fast food in my neighborhood. I'm much less likely to be incarcerated for the same offenses as a person of color. For example, a black youth arrested first time for drug possession is 48 more times likely to serve jail time than a white youth arrested for the same crime. My white-sounding name makes it 50% more likely that I'll be called back for a job interview than if I had an African-American-sounding name. I don't have to worry about people suspecting I'm a terrorist after whites like Timothy McVeigh blow up buildings. I don't have to worry about housing discrimination. I've had the opportunity for a superlative education from kindergarten right through graduate school. And I see all sorts of positive images of whites in the media. When I go to Harry Potter or The Lord of the Rings, my heroes look like me. Think about The Lord of the Rings for a moment. 100% of the people portrayed in that movie who are on top of the earth are white. That's where the good people are. The evil orcs reside deep in the earth, and they are relentlessly evil and black. Well, a theme emerges from these privileges, many themes, but one of them is that I have less to worry about. This doesn't mean that my life's been easy or perfect, but I have less to worry about. And there are benefits to less worry, including a health benefit, part of the reason why I can expect to live longer than an African American. The interesting thing about all of these privileges is that, for the most part, I don't even notice them. Like, I didn't notice that I wasn't being asked to give my ID, to show my ID at the University of Chicago, until I heard from someone who was asked all the time to show his. I didn't think about the images of blacks and whites in The Lord of the Rings until someone pointed it out to me. I didn't notice that security guards don't follow me around stores until I talked to a person of color in Appleton who shared that she often has that experience. All of these experiences to me felt like they're normal. Like, this is the way life is. I haven't gotten out of the car enough to know that this is not the way life is for everybody. And this kind of environment I have been in explains how a company could be oblivious enough to name a crayon color flesh when that color, alas, is the color of white skin. Of course, the flip side of white privilege is disadvantage for people of color. My privilege has been built on disadvantages for people of color. Housing discrimination against people of color means that I have more apartments and houses to choose from. People with African-American-sounding names not getting calls back for interviews means that I'm more likely to get a call back for an interview. Benefiting from white privilege does not mean that I am a racist. Not realizing it, not admitting it, though, well, that has a lot to do with what keeps the engines of racism churning in this country. So, what can we do about this? If your story is like mine and you step out of the car and you start noticing things, I want to share today three not-so-easy steps. I'm going to get more in detail in the coming weeks, but these three steps I want to share today. The first thing I think we can do is internal work, what Rebecca Parker calls soul work. This is the work of awakening. It includes deciding that racism matters. For me, deciding that I'm part of the problem and could be part of the solution. It includes not stepping back into the car because this work is so darn hard and I have a choice about whether or not I want to do it. The second not-so-easy step is to build skills, to build competence, to live in this multicultural world we live in. Current neuroscience and psychology, they have some good news and some bad news about this. The bad news is that everybody has prejudice. We seem to be hardwired to favor being with people who look like us. By the age of 3, kids prefer to play with people who look like they look. The good news, though, is that we have, each of us, the power to stop our prejudiced thoughts, which seem to be often automatic, from being expressed in discrimination, in racism, in words, in actions. The brain is amazingly malleable. And it's possible through training, through practice, to override some of this innate prejudice. Egalitarianism, it turns out, can be a skill that's learned. So how do we build these skills? There's lots of ways. One is to open ourselves to books and movies and other media that tell us, that allow us to step outside our comfortable car and learn about other people's lives. We can also build our skills by talking with people who are different from us. This is tricky. For one thing, it's hard when we live in segregated society to find people who are different from us. And it's not the job of people of color to teach us. But when we do have friendships and acquaintances with people who are different from us and we listen, we truly can learn a lot. And also, like any skill set, we can develop our skills by making mistakes and learning from those. And this is really tough because most of us who are white hate to make mistakes when it comes to race. We hate to feel like we're racist. Not a good feeling. So I find it helpful to remember that racism is a continuum, that it's not an either-or proposition. As a white, I'm on a continuum from less racist to more racist. I've used the phrase here before that I'm a recovering racist, which reminds me of this continuum. It reminds me that I am still racist, but I'm working to try to be less racist. And in this work, mistakes help me learn. They help me gain skill. They don't mean I'm a horrible person. This mindset helps me risk more and be less defensive in this really tricky work. The third step, not so easy, is action. Talk is cheap, ultimately. Action's what counts. I'll talk more about this in the coming weeks. Well, I hope, maybe, that you've noticed today I haven't talked about shame and guilt. We white Unitarian Universalists have wasted a lot of time and energy on shame and guilt in recent decades. There's been a whole lot of self-flagellation, and it hasn't gotten us anywhere. Guilt and shame are really not good motivators for this work. They're not constructive. So then the question, why try to end racism? If I'm honest, I have to acknowledge as a white person, I get some privileges that would end if racism ends. Why do this work? It's not necessarily in my self-interest, it would appear. Why do this work? Well, first of all, because it's the right thing to do. And our faith is about doing the right thing. Without reward, you don't get a good afterlife in our faith because you do the right thing. We do the right thing because that's how we build a better world. But there is something very big in this work for each of us personally. Racism is corrosive and it's fragmenting for the racist as well as those who are hurt by racism. It splits mind from body from soul. It splits neighbor from neighbor. My mythic picture of the corrosive impact of racism on a soul is Voldemort from Harry Potter. Here was a person who, through magic, literally fragments his soul into many pieces, and from that place of fragmentation, he constructs a life built on a foundation of hatred for those who appear different. The UU theologian Sandeika writes that, to get to wholeness, one has to go back and retrieve the parts of oneself that have been left behind. How can you not think of Voldemort when you hear that quotation? That's the work he needed to do, to go back and retrieve the parts of himself and integrate himself into a whole. But he could not do that. His blinding hatred did not allow him to do that work. So there are profound costs for staying in the car. A lack of wholeness. Living in a world as a disembodied spectator, in Parker's words. Living a life that's cut off from a whole lot of beautiful, like us, also flawed people. All of this really can destroy the soul, and that's a pretty high cost. And there's one more cost. The truth is that that car that that car is separate is a fiction. We belong to one another across racial lines. We inhabit the same planet. We're brothers and sisters. And in this work to dismantle racism, there is a prize that is far greater than any privilege being white can give us. And that is being truly part of the great, wondrous, beautiful, complicated whole of humanity. And that's the prize that I seek.